Good afternoon and welcome to Woods and Water, South Carolina. Kind of chilly out there, isn't it? The cold front came through and hello winter. I hope you're having a great day. I'm actually in Charleston at a football game, which is, I think I've maybe been to 3 or 4 football games my entire life. So this is quite an accomplishment for my daughter to get me out of the woods this time of the year, sit in a stand and watch a guy throw pigskins around. But I'm sure I'm having fun. It's family time, and you know, these times don't come very often. You take advantage of them when you can. Like last weekend, Taylor and I took a couple of days and went deer hunting. Just a wonderful time to be around your kids and all. So I'm happy you tuned in. You can tune in every Saturday afternoon at, from 3 to 4, and I'd love to have you listen. Speaking of deer hunting and cold temperatures, you know, cold front's coming through. Deer ought to really be moving. I'm gonna get some time in the woods. But, you know, Taylor's been going deer hunting with me for probably 5 years, maybe 6, and she's only 12. So she spent a lot of time in the tree stand with me. And, you know, there's the old saying that you can take a kid hunting and you can go hunting, but you can't take a kid hunting. And you can do that with fishing, too. And that's the attitude you have to take. You know, when they're young, it's all about them. You know, when they quit having fun, trust me, you quit having fun and just leave. But she's at an age now, she wants to go deer hunting. And so we went out. She knows how to shoot a rifle. And I said, okay, all right, one practice round. Let's see how you do. And it was touching the center dot on a target at 75 yards. I said, that's good. That's as long a shot as you're going to take. And she spent about 9 hours in the stand over a couple of days. Never got frustrated. Always found something fun to point out, or, you know, get excited about the squirrels, the birds, fallen leaves. You have the imagination playing tricks with you as it got dark. There's a deer. No, actually, it's a limb with a couple of dead branches hanging down. You know, it's amazing what your imagination will do to you in a deer stand. But, you know, she set her standards early. It was, I'll shoot a buck. It's got to be 4 points or better. And I'll shoot a doe, but it cannot have little ones with it. So we hunted an evening, a morning, and an evening. And the last evening, we stalked up on a deer that was crossing the pasture and got close enough. It was standing on the edge of the woods. She had the gun up, ready to take a shot. And as the deer turned sideways, broadside to us, I looked and I saw two little ones. I said, Taylor, it's got little ones with it. She put the gun down, said, well, that was fun. So that's the enjoying part about kids. So hang on, we're going to talk to Marty Walker with Palmetto Boat Center about an upcoming event we've got going on. You know, you've heard a lot of FLW and BASS pros on the show. You've heard a lot of college anglers on the show. And today we're delving into a new area for Woods and Water, South Carolina's high school bass fishing. And who better to talk about it than Marty Walker from Palmetto Boat Center. Marty, how are you today?
Well, I'm doing great, Roger. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Look, folks, if you don't know, Palmetto Boat Center's moved. They're down there on I-85 now, got a nice big place, and I see you filled the lots up with lots of new boats for people to come by.
Well, you know, the thing that's funny, Roger, is when we moved in back in June, we started on a Sunday afternoon with a complete empty lot, a bunch of volunteers.
Uh-huh.
And about 4 to 5 hours later, we had moved every boat from our facility on 123 to the new facility on Interstate 85 at exit 35, and we filled up the lot. And so everybody thinks that we bought all these new boats and used boats and things for the new building, new business, new facility.
Yeah.
But man, we've been doing this for 15 years,
yeah. And
we just ran out of space at our other building. It's funny because people kept coming by, wow, we didn't know you were here. And so there's this perception in the Anderson area that we're the new big boat dealer out on 85. Yeah, and I keep telling them, no, I mean, yes, we're new, but we're not new.
Oh, me. Well, 15 years is a long time. So you got Palmetto Boat Center. Let's see, you got Phoenix Boats, got Nitro.
Phoenix, Nitro. We just signed this week with Legend Boats.
Oh, wow.
So we've got several Legend Boats on order.
All right.
And then, you know, we sell a bunch of pontoons.
Yep.
We sell Tracker aluminum fishing boats, which a lot of your listeners would really be into. They've got bass boats, crappie boats, multi-species boats, hunting boats, you know.
Yeah.
Bow fishing boats. We've got stuff for everything.
Very good. Well, you're kind of the head guy when it comes to high school bass fishing around the upstate, and it's something
I don't know that I would go that far.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll go that far. Okay. I mean, well, you run a high school tournament trail up here.
We do. We started 2 years ago, and we did a fall and a spring tournament with the customer and his club at Brim High School.
Okay.
And then we went and met with some folks down at DNR and several coaches from some high schools in the other areas, and we just developed a trail. There was a need for central organization. Mm-hmm. And for a calendar, because nobody knew when the next event was going to be or where it was going to be. And it was almost a field of dreams kind of moment, because if you build it, they'll come.
Yeah.
And so last year we averaged 120 to 140 votes per tournament. This year in the second season, we had 202 at our first tournament. We had 243 votes last weekend on Hartwell.
You know,
and so it's just amazing, the growth and the participation.
And when you say 200, or what, 243 votes?
243 votes.
Okay.
That's four high school students per vote, plus a boat captain volunteer.
Yeah, that's 486 kids who are bass fishing on a day, along with 243 adults who have bass boats who have donated, not just probably that day, but many more days in the past as coaches or boat captains. So you got over 700 people out on the water in the outdoors fishing.
Not counting spectators, mom, grandma, you know, little sister or little brother that come to see what's going on at weigh-in. We had a huge crowd.
Yeah.
You know, the guys that won are from up in the Lake Wylie area. They won last year and this year.
Oh, wow.
Brent Myers, uh-huh, is an Elite Series pro, and his son and partner, you know, won the tournament.
Oh, well, that's cheating.
Well, no, because he's not an Elite Series pro on Saturday morning.
That's right.
He's dad.
You know. That's exactly right.
And they won by a huge margin.
Oh, really?
5/100ths of a pound.
5/100ths of a pound.
That's it. But the thing that's really exciting is just the number of kids that are getting involved.
Yeah.
It gives them an opportunity to develop the passion for the outdoors that so many of us have.
Yep.
And there's so many life lessons that you learn through bass fishing. Because there's the competitive side, but there's ethics, there's etiquette, there's, you know, speaking and presentation, because you get the opportunity to be in front of some groups. You know, and I think you're going to see, as this progresses over the next few years, there's going to be some Elite Series pros that will come out of this.
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt.
And so that's really one other thing that we're excited about coming up in January. On January 13th and 14th, we're partnering, of course, with you, Woods and Water, and Anderson County, the Convention and Visitors Bureau in Anderson County, and several other sponsors to do a high school bass class. We're going to bring a lot of these students in, a lot of these boat captains in, give them the opportunity to meet some professionals, local professionals as well as national professionals.
Right.
And let them spend time with them for a day, do a lot of education, do a lot of training, and we can share a lot more details on that in a couple of weeks. But it's something that if there's any students listening, they need to mark January 13th and 14th down on their calendar.
Yeah, it's going to be an exciting weekend. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to bring them in Friday. Registration, I won't spring the secret. We got a great keynote speaker for Friday night. Saturday morning, hit the ground running. They're going to have classes that these elites and FLW pros and local pros are teaching about what they need to know out on the water. Both fishing and, like you said, etiquette and boat handling and all. You're going to feed them, you know, it's just going to be a great time. Hopefully have some goodie bags to give away to some of them, maybe some prizes and all, and send them home hopefully a better fisherman than when they got there.
Well, and if there's any companies out there listening that want to get involved with us, reach out to me at Palmetto Boat Center or, of course, you at Woods and Water, and we'll try to get you involved to find a way for you to contribute.
Absolutely. Marty, I appreciate you coming on and kind of teasing Palmetto Boat Center, the high school bass fishing trail, and this event we got coming up. I think next week you and Neil and I are going to give the whole spiel with who's coming and really start the process for getting these kids registered and coming in.
Nothing like a little drama and anticipation.
Nothing like it. Look, you have a great day. We both talked about how busy we are. Look forward to doing this again next Saturday.
You got it. Can't
wait. Thanks, Marty. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Roger.
Yes, sir.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. If you like to cook, This is the segment for you. A couple of quotes here. As one of the leading authorities on wild game cooking, Scott Latsis can make virtually anything wearing fur, feathers, or fins come deliciously alive. That's the Denver Post. And right down the street in Charleston, South Carolina, the Post and Courier says he's practically a crusader when it comes to teaching fellow hunters and fishermen how to make tasty use of what they catch. Scott, thanks for taking the time out of your day to be with us on Woods and Water, South Carolina.
Always good to be in South Carolina, anywhere. That's kind of a second home for me. We had a place there for a long time.
I know you did. And are you coming back anytime soon? I know you're busy.
I'm going to be in the area in February. I'll be doing some stuff with South Carolina Waterfowl, and I may be at the Southeast Wildlife Expo in Charleston. We're still working out a few details.
Oh, wow. That would be that's a great place to be out there every year, and those folks do a great job with that event.
Well, they do the Sportsman's Ball.
Right.
I'm not sure exactly what night that is. And I used to do that with them with Charleston Gourmet Catering. And
okay.
It's been a while, but I think I'm going to be in the neighborhood, and I think I'll be able to help out and cook a few things.
Well, that'd be good. I look forward to seeing you there then.
All right.
That's one place I'm always going to. Well, today, venison. Deer season is wide open here, and I want to talk about cooking and processing and game care and all, but I want to take just a second and have you introduce yourself to the listeners. You have a long history in the outdoors, and then with the cooking, the chef, and the books and the TV shows. Just take a second and tell everybody who you are.
Well, I've got a show on Sportsman Channel called The Sporting Chef, and I've been on Sportsman Channel since they started many years ago. I've spent a lot of time in South Carolina with their Camp Woody, the South Carolina Waterfowl Association. And the reason why I have such a long history is because I'm an old guy. I've been doing this for a long time. I had a restaurant back in the 80s where we served fish and game, and people would bring their game into us.
Oh, wow.
And we'd show them what it's supposed to taste like. It's really, really, my whole goal is to simplify it. I'm not trying to out-chef anybody.
Okay.
I don't try and find ingredients that you can't find. My whole goal is to make you appreciate the fish and game that you drag home more than you might possibly do now.
All right, I got to ask you, what's the most bizarre thing you've ever served?
Well, I've got another show called Dead Meat on Sportsman Channel, which we're hoping to revive here. It's owned by Sportsman Channel. And,
okay.
Armadillo was a little odd. It's the only animal that can transmit leprosy to humans.
Oh, wow.
And if you cook it all the way through, you can avoid all that. And if you do happen to get leprosy, you can cure it with antibiotics. But really, there's so many other things to eat. Why would you want to eat an armadillo just to say you did, right?
But
python was horrible. We did python in the Everglades.
Okay.
Just not edible, high in mercury. The worst thing, we were out in the Mexican-Texas border, and
right.
This guy served me a machito, which is goat heart, liver, and lungs, wrapped with goat intestines and tied with goat fat, and it was a bit undercooked, and I would highly recommend against it. How's that? Hey, you asked.
Good answer. Better you than me. How's that?
I just had to eat a bite. It was all for TV, you know?
Okay. Well, you mentioned the armadillo. I think there's a picture of you out there with you and the armadillo on a serving tray.
There is. Yeah. It's, and we did eat that one, but I didn't eat the whole thing.
Okay. Well, venison. Deer season's here. A lot of people are out. I've been out. I actually took my daughter this weekend. Didn't connect, but she had a chance. And, I have to hand it to her. It was a doe with a couple of yearlings, and she passed it up. She goes, I just not going to do that. So we're 0 for 4 or 5 hunts now, but you got a long season to go through. But I want to, you've got a long history in the outdoors, hunting, fishing, you cook what you kill like most people that hunt do. And some of these questions are kind of, when I looked at them, I was like, gosh, I don't really know if he can answer those or if he's got an opinion, but you said you liked them, so here we go. Processing.
Yep.
It used to be it was all the old freezer paper and you froze it. Now I know a lot of processors are spending upwards of $70,000, $80,000, $100,000 to get shrink wrap machines. Any one better than the other, in your opinion?
Shrink wrap machine by far.
Okay.
Whether it's a food saver deal that you happen to have at home, or if the processor has the commercial one that you can put wet food in. It's better.
Okay.
If you've got a properly sealed, vacuum-packed hunk of deer meat, it's not going to get freezer burn. Whereas,
right.
How many times have you opened up a paper-wrapped one, and you go, man, you've got to cut off part of it, it gets freezer burn. Really, the only way that I know to avoid it is by properly vacuum-packing it. A lot of people have a problem because let's say they've got a moist piece of deer meat that
right.
maybe they haven't bled as well as should have, or aged it as long as they should have. So you're putting paper towels in there to kind of keep you're looking at it going, man, I hope this seals before the juice runs into the chamber
right.
and makes it not seal, right? We've all seen that.
Right.
Take your deer steaks and freeze them first. Once they're just frozen, then vacuum pack them, and you're never going to have that problem with juice running out, and you can do it at home.
You brought up a question of aging. I remember back in the late 70s, early 80s, when I was first starting out deer hunting, when the deer were finally huntable here in South Carolina where I hunted. We always used to let them hang for a week. That was, the processor, actually the check station had it. And you paid them a per day rate for 7 or 8 days to hang it. Then you took it to a processor. Is aging it important when it comes to venison?
It is, especially with an older animal. With a younger animal, not nearly as much. And once you break it down, if you've got big roasts, if you've got large hunks, if you just take that and put it into your refrigerator on a rack with a drip pan underneath. And leave it in there for a couple of weeks. Now, you're going to think, man, it's going to get discolored. Don't wrap it. Don't cover it. What you're going to do is you're evaporating a lot of that capillary blood, a lot of the blood that you're not getting out by hanging it.
Okay.
And it's going to make it an infinitely more tender, especially if it's a bigger chunk, a tender roast.
Right.
You can do it with steaks. Leave your steak out there for a week or so. You've heard about 28-day dry-aged meat.
Okay.
The problem is it loses a lot of weight, but the weight that it loses is actually just it's waste blood, and it's stuff that you don't want to eat anyway.
Okay.
And it's going to be a lot more tender if you age it properly.
Wow. And that's the thing. Now you take it to a processor, and in 3 days he's calling you back saying it's ready to come pick it up.
Yeah, and it's not ready to come pick up.
Okay. Speaking of processors, what are, there's a ton of them out there around South Carolina, around the nation. Is there anything you'd suggest for hunters to consider when they choose a processor?
The meat has to be properly trimmed. If you get deer steaks back that some guys put on a bandsaw and has not separated each of the muscles, that's not going to do you any good. If he also says, I'll give you the loins, I'll save you the back straps and the tenderloins,
okay.
and then I'm going to grind everything else into burger and sausage, that's not doing me a favor either. If he'll take the hind quarter and remove each muscle, and you can go online, there's several examples of what a properly trimmed hunk of deer meat, whether it's a top round or a bottom round or a sirloin, it shouldn't have any white on it. It should just be muscle. And you're going to lose some meat out of it. But, you've got that silver skin on there that doesn't taste good, smell
right.
good. Your body doesn't process it. Get rid of it. And if they won't do that and they're going to give you a cheap deal just to break it down, take it home and take a little time with a good sharp fillet knife and remove each muscle and get rid of all the junk that's not muscle.
So how easy is it to self-process a deer?
It's no big deal. I mean, as long as you've got a garage where you can hang it up, you break it down, and then you take each of the separate parts and you just start working your knife. Typically with a shoulder or a neck
okay.
or shanks, I don't break them down. I cook them whole. That's something I'm gonna put into a smoker until it's almost like pulled pork.
Okay.
When it gets to a certain temperature, you wrap it in foil with some sauce and just let the heat do its job to break it down, or you can braise it with a couple of cans of beer in an oven, and eventually you can take that bone-in deer shoulder, and it'll fall apart. You just grab the bone, and the meat just falls right off, and that stuff I'm going to use for tacos and chili and sauces and things like that.
And what about the people who argue that that's going to dry the meat out too much, smoking it?
Well, it's not going to dry it out if you go low temp, and once you get it to, if you get a bone-in deer shoulder and you get it to about 185 degrees, wrap it in foil, And before you do that, put some barbecue sauce or beer or whatever. You're going to need some moisture in there.
Okay.
And that way it's going to be wrapped in heavy-duty foil.
Okay.
Don't buy standard foil. That should be illegal. Wrap it in heavy-duty foil and then leave it in there for a couple hours, and it's going to completely fall apart. If you braise it, if you brown it, put it into a roasting pan with some celery, carrots, onions, some either wine or beer, cover it up with foil and leave it in there for 8-9 hours at about 250 to 300 degrees.
Yeah.
It's not going to dry out because you've got moist
right.
heat in there, and that meat's just going to fall right apart.
All right. This one. What are some of your sleeper cuts for venison? Some of the underused or underrated that most people just look at the list and go, I don't want that.
How about shanks, man? Do you eat the shanks? Do you save those? They're so good. You take that bottom leg portion, just like ossobuco. I mean, we eat veal shanks,
okay.
and, you know, so why not a deer shank? A lot of people will cut them up into little rings and use them as dog treats. If you take those deer shanks and you brown them and then you braise them, like I was talking about with those shoulders, you have to tie a string around them.
Okay.
Because, and I'm doing like 4-inch long sections. Tie a string around them because once they're done, they completely fall off the bone. They're so tender.
Wow.
So you brown it, put it into a roasting pan. I'm going to go with some tomato, fresh herb, red wine, a little balsamic vinegar, and that juice that you put in there is going to be nice and syrupy by the time you're done, and you're going to have this completely fall-off-the-bone deer shank that's great flavor. Put that on a big pile of mashed potatoes, and you're good to go.
And where does that come from, the shank?
The bottom leg, the leg section. So if you look below the knee on both the hind and front legs,
right,
and you're going to go down until it's, you know, you get to the point
sure.
where it's just bone.
Right.
So right where the meat hits the bone in the bottom portion, and then up to the knee, all of that you can cut into sections and braise it, and it's going to be incredibly good. If you get to the point you're going, man, this just isn't tender, you haven't cooked it long enough.
Okay.
If you cook it with moist heat covered low temperature, it's going to take several hours, but eventually it's going to completely fall apart, and it's incredibly delicious.
Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. So is your mouth watering yet? Hey, we got more with Scott Lason. Well, what are some of the common mistakes people make when they cook venison?
Number one, by far, is to overcook it. You know, I'll ask people, how do you cook your deer? And they go, well, we cook it all the way through.
Okay.
So if you cook it all the way through until it's gray in the center, what you're going to have, because it is so very lean, and I mean, it's 10 times leaner than beef. There's
right.
just no fat running through these things. So it's not very forgiving. You're going to get a mutton-y, livery deer steak. What I find with a lot of people that say, I don't like deer, is somebody served them a rubbery old deer steak that wasn't properly handled. If you take even some of the hindquarter steaks that are just fine, but let's give it a good chance, and we'll use a backstrap.
Okay.
Cut that into steaks. If you cut it in half and you cook half of it medium rare and the other half all the way through or medium well done, it's two completely different pieces of meat. So if you grew up eating well done steaks and you just can't help yourself, then you're stuck with stews and chilies and soups and
okay.
those kinds of things.
Okay.
Unless you really like a tough rubbery deer steak, which I don't. So take 15 seconds out of your life and try a less cooked deer steak. I promise nothing bad's going to happen. You know, the other thing is people don't trim their deer steaks. If you've, like I talked about, that cross section of a deer where you've got all the different parts of the hindquarter, for instance, with a bone in the center of it.
Okay.
A deer steak shouldn't have bone in it.
Right.
And it shouldn't have anything white on it. It should be trimmed properly and use the proper cooking method for different parts of your deer. The shanks, you go slow, low and slow. Shoulder roast, neck roast. Take your time. You can't do it quickly. The better parts, the better hindquarter muscles, the loins and the tenderloins, cook it fast and hot and not overcooked.
The veritable venison burger. Everybody gets it. You know, you can get it plain. You can get it added beef fat. You can add bacon to it with some processors. Is there anything magic about adding fat or bacon to it that you can't do just with straight venison burger?
Well, you know, the straight venison burger is good if it's, and I like to do a coarse ground, not a fine grind.
And why?
Because when it's fine grinded, it's like when you make venison chili with a fine ground venison, it ends up with little BB sized venison in there.
Okay.
I like it to be I like it a little chunkier.
Okay.
And I add about 20% of either ground pork or ground fat. When I'm grinding it myself, I'll throw in some pork shoulder.
Okay.
I'll use chorizo, which is a Mexican sausage, which gives it some really good flavor.
Okay.
And I like to mix it up. I'll take blue cheese, mix that in there. I'll take mushrooms, throw that in there. Peppers, grind it up if I'm making a burger so that it's got more flavor to it. And don't be afraid to season it, because venison doesn't come pre-seasoned.
Right.
And a lot of people just don't season it enough. Anything you can put into a beef burger to make it taste better, you can do with a venison burger. There are those people who just like plain ground burger, nothing in it. But you know, the same people might also like it overcooked. I'm cooking my venison burger, and this is strictly my choice.
All right,
mine's going to be medium rare.
Okay, and that goes back to no fat in it and coming up with a chewy hamburger.
Yeah. Well, it's going to, if you don't have any fat added to it, it's going to be chewier.
Okay,
you can cook a deer burger with no fat added to it. And you can cook it medium rare, and it's going to be fine. But I like to add some flavor to it. There are people who, it's strictly a matter of personal choice, that just don't like to go too far out when it comes to cooking anything.
Right.
You know, they're the meat and potatoes people.
Right. Right.
That's their choice. You know what? It doesn't affect me what somebody else eats, but I like to add a little bit more flavor to mine. And if all I did was cook my deer the same way every time, then I wouldn't be able to have a cookbook or a TV show.
Understand that. And see, my wife is at home cringing because she likes it double ground. So, and I don't know why. I think it's more her palate than anything. I don't think,
right.
I mean, even when we have chili out or something, she doesn't like big chunks of meat. I think that's just her.
Right. And that's her personal preference. That's hers. What she does with
yes.
her chili is fine. So.
That's right. The trouble
I'm just
is
telling you how I do it. I don't want to make the wife mad.
Oh no, she's not going to get mad. In fact, she's probably home making a list of, hey, well, I might like to try this, or next one you get, maybe we'll try this, because normally what we do is we get the back straps whole, and then
right.
the rest of it ground up. Simply because I think it's, you know, she didn't grow up eating it. She started when we got married shortly after, you know, and really the only thing she could do was hide it in spaghetti and, you know, chili and that.
Right.
But at the same time, she appreciates that, you know, she didn't have to go to the grocery store and buy it. It's good for you. It's, you know, there's no chemicals in it or anything unless you get close to where the bullet went through. But, you know, it's, I think she really appreciates it. I think there's a lot of people out there that appreciate that fact. That it is.
Well, I have to lie to my wife every now and then about
okay.
what it is we're eating, because she, believe it or not, she's not a big wild game aficionado. It's not her thing, and yet she's married to somebody who does that for a living. I do a venison cooking blog for Winchester every week.
Okay,
and I was doing last year I was doing venison bulgogi, which is a Korean marinated venison. And she came home from work, and she said, "What are you doing?" I said, "You know, I'm making a photo for Winchester, but it's not. It looks like venison, but it's really beef. But you
okay.
know, it's a photo, so whatever." So she said, "Okay, well," she took the plate and went outside, and I got out to her when she had about one piece left, and I said, "Nah, that's venison." And so she stopped eating it. She wouldn't eat the last piece, because she said, you lied to me. And I said, well, look, you wouldn't have eaten it if I hadn't lied to you. And you liked it, right? She goes, yeah. And there's still a lot of people out there that are just not going to eat venison, at least not willingly.
It's safe to say you can pretty much do with venison what you can do with beef?
Basically, the rule that applies is you just don't want to cook it as long if it's one of the primal cuts. Use a meat thermometer, go to 135 internal temperature on a steak. And yes, anything you can do with beef, you can do with venison. You just might have to add a little fat. You might have to tweak it a little bit for the cooking process, but you can turn your favorite beef recipe, you can change that into venison anytime.
What's your favorite cut, if you had to pick one?
Well, you know, it kind of changes, but I like most people, I'm partial to backstraps.
Okay.
But what I don't do is cut them into little medallions and butterfly them, which I find one of the most annoying practices out there for the processors.
Okay.
I don't know who decided that's a good idea. I'd rather get a whole backstrap, trim that silver skin on the outside, take a fillet knife and butterfly the whole thing, stuff it with some fresh herbs and mushrooms and maybe some blue cheese and tie the whole thing up, rub it with olive oil, salt, and pepper, cook it on a grill until it's just done and still a little bit purple in the center, let it rest, cut it into medallions, and put a little sauce on top of that. You know, that's a pretty good way to eat that.
And I know why you put the thought just left me. You're coated it with olive oil, right?
Olive oil, huh?
And I know why. Tell everybody why you coat it with olive oil before putting it on the grill.
Well, it's gonna help it brown on the outside. You rub it with olive oil, it adds a little fat to the outside, which will get it a little crispier. I like meat that's a little charred on the outside. It's gonna add a little bit of moisture, but really what it does do is it helps for browning on the outside. And you've heard people on TV say that if you brown it on the outside, it will seal in the juices. Well, that's not true, but it sure does sound good. When you brown it on the outside, it just tastes better. I like a good, crusty deer on the outside. I like it black and blue.
Okay.
A hot cast iron skillet, slap a deer steak in there, get it crusty on the outside, and still medium rare on the inside. To me, I like that. You get the texture, and then you get this not-overcooked, delicious, moist piece of deer on the inside.
Going back to your whole backstrap stuff with whatever you stuffed it with, what would you serve with that?
You know, if I've got the grill going, I'm going to grill some vegetables that I've also tossed with olive oil and salt and pepper. Garlic, mashed potatoes, rice, whatever starch you got. It's a matter of personal preference, but I'm kind of partial to, you know, grilled in-season vegetables.
Okay.
You take some of the fall and winter squash that we have right now,
okay,
and make a little puree out of that with some acorn squash and set it right on top of that. That's pretty good, too.
Wow. Any last thoughts on venison?
No, man, just different parts of the deer, cook them differently. Don't be afraid to try it less cooked than what you're doing now. Nothing bad is going to happen. What you may end up with is a deer that you appreciate more, that's not tough and livery and gaming.
Oh, wow. Well, you got a second? I got one more question I'd love to ask you.
Sure.
You know, we're blessed in South Carolina. We've got saltwater coastline. Shrimp season opens up mid-September for recreational shrimping. The commercial shrimpers are going out there through November, mid-November, early December, and bringing in shrimp. And I've read a bunch of articles about, you know, the upside to, you know, locally caught wild shrimp and the downside to commercially raised imported shrimp. What are your thoughts on it? What do you think about the imported market?
You know, when you're buying shrimp, you want to always check the country of origin.
Okay.
If it's from Southeast Asia, there's a good chance that it was raised in questionable waters. There's no controls there.
Okay.
What does get inspected over here is such a minuscule amount. I always buy American from American shrimpers. You know, you guys in South Carolina have some of the best shrimp in the world. When we go, when I go with my South Carolina guys to duck hunt in Canada, one of the things that we bring to the farmers in Canada is South Carolina shrimp.
You would not believe the duck hunters I know who do that very thing.
Well, because they don't get it there. They're going to get, you know, the tiger shrimp and the other stuff that's raised in a septic tank in Vietnam somewhere.
Right.
And they're not getting, yours is briny, it's salty, it's fatty, I love it. Save those shells when you're doing that too, with those shrimp shells.
Uh-huh.
Put it with some celery, carrot, onion, a little bit of water into a pot, stock pot, and then about 30 to 45 minutes, you can make a delicious shrimp stock. You pour the whole thing through a colander. You can reduce that. Use that when you're sautéing fish. Use it when you're cooking other shrimp. Make the shrimp stock. But, yeah, really, American shrimp, what you all have is, I'm jealous because the Pacific Coast shrimp that we get here doesn't have nearly the flavor that y'all does.
And why is that? The water temperature, salt salinity levels, what do you think?
I don't know, man. I could make something up, but I don't know what it is. The water is a lot colder on the Pacific Coast,
right,
than it is on the Atlantic Coast. I don't know what it is, but any of the warmer water shrimp, you know, Gulf shrimp, what you all have there, it, to me, is the best. If I'm going to bring something home from South Carolina, shrimp, it's likely to be shrimp,
it's
going to be fresh.
You know, you mentioned shrimp stock, and one of the recipes that I cook in the fall a lot is seafood chipeno.
Uh-huh.
It's a San Francisco recipe, I think. It's kind of
supposed to be, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it originated from, you know, all the fishermen come through and they just toss in the pot whatever they had and they cook it right there on the shore. But I combined about three or four, and one of the ones that I came up with was exactly what you said. I used my shrimp peels to make shrimp stock to use as the base for the soup.
That's a great way to start that. And you can make, you can make fish stock too, but if you're long on shrimp,
yeah,
make the shrimp stock. That's going to give it another dimension and more depth of flavor when you do the chipino. And do you use blue crab and fish and whatever else you got in there? You know, it's meant, you kind of, the one that I eat, we use Dungeness crab, which is a little bigger.
Right.
And you're going to have some big chunks of crab in the shell that are going to be sitting in there, and you get it's a job to eat it, but it's well worth it.
It's a job to cook it too. It's
a
4 hour process to do it, but yeah, I mix it up. I'll use you know, some bay scallops and some mussels maybe, and then mahi is pretty much the fish I use,
right,
just because it soaks up and becomes whatever, you know, the whole flavor of the chipeno itself. But yeah, some claw meat out of some crabs, and it's a good fall winter recipe, boy. Mm.
And the what takes the time is the stock, to me, is the
yes,
base. And you're not putting, I'm not putting the fish and all the crab and the scallops in there until right towards the very end.
Oh yeah, maybe 6 or 7 minutes left to go.
I'm making the stock. Yeah, I don't want to turn that in. I don't want to disintegrate my fish part.
All right. While I got you, and we got a minute, roasted peppers.
Yep.
What is it about roasting a red bell pepper that just makes it the flavor pop?
It's a whole different pepper, you know. If you don't want to bother putting it out on the grill outside, if you just take a pepper and you hold it with tongs over your open flame in the kitchen,
okay,
that works just fine. What you want to do is you want to get it black on the outside,
right?
Throw it into a paper bag, close that paper bag, and just let it steam in there for a little while. And then once, you know, if you leave it in there for about 10 or 15 minutes, then you scrape the black part of the skin off.
Right.
And it's so good. And I like to grill different colored peppers.
Okay.
Especially when they're in season, and serve that as a side dish. You can marinate them. You know, you can take a roasted red bell pepper or any kind of pepper, throw it into a blender with a little bit of heavy cream, salt, pepper, and a squeeze of lemon or lime juice, and just pulse that until it's really, really smooth. And use that as a sauce. It's great on shrimp, especially if you throw a jalapeno pepper in there, too, that you've roasted.
Right.
Give it a little bit of heat. It's great on chicken. It's great on fish. I'm a fan of the roasted peppers.
Oh, I am, too. I mean, I cook with them. But boy, when you roast them, it's a whole different ball game.
Yeah, it is.
Well, Scott, I appreciate it so much. Please tell us, where can people find your TV show? Where can they find you? You got some cookbooks out there. You got blogs out there. You got the Sporting Chef email list. Tell us how people can get a hold of you and follow you.
Well, my weekly blog is whitetail.winchester. It's a venison cooking blog. I've got the Sporting Chef show is on Sportsman Channel Monday, Wednesday, Saturday, Sunday. 12:30 p.m. on Sunday is kind of the prime airing.
Okay.
We've got people from all over the country that are contributing to it. I'm also the cooking editor for Ducks Unlimited magazine.
Right.
So I'm in the DU magazine a lot. And if you go to sportingchef.com, there's a whole bunch of free recipes there that'll give you some ideas on what to do with your own fishing game.
Very good. Mouth is watered, so I guess that's a good segment on the radio. I appreciate you doing it. And look, if you are coming to Seawee, I'd love to meet up with you and at least get to shake your hand. We've talked several times on the phone and always had a good time. But if you're going to be around Charleston, please let me know. I'd love to meet up with you.
We'll do it, man. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Did your mouth water over the last 30 minutes? Check your pulse if it didn't. Scott's just a wealth of information. Always a fun time when he's on the show. I hope he makes it to the Southeastern Wildlife Expo. Be good to see him there, and maybe they'll let him cook. Who knows? Sporting Clays. Love it. Haven't done it in a long time. Just started doing it again. I'm a member of the Southeastern Outdoor Press Association and the South Carolina Outdoor Press Association, and got some great guys that you rub shoulders with. One of those is Jim Mize. He actually lives right here in Greenville. Writes a blog for Rethink Rural, and he's almost a contemporary to Patrick McManus, if any of you remember the back page of Outdoor Life and his humor stories. And Jim writes a story here that I got that says, Sporting Clays like golf with a gun. He said, there's an old joke that Sporting Clays is like golf with a gun. It's been described like that. For the uninitiated, this is a sport in which the shooter moves from station to station, shooting at clay targets flung through the air, each station being different. You might have a rabbit. You might have a clay coming at you, one crossing right to left, one springing straight up in the air. It's always different at each station. He says, in some ways, golf and Sporting Clays have their similarities. For instance, during a round of Sporting Clays, I often have the urge to wrap my barrel around a tree or toss my shotgun into a water hazard. And we've seen golfers do that. People compare it to Sporting Clays to golf for several reasons. First, golf is a popular and well-known sport that many of us can relate to. Second, both sports offer a leisurely stroll outdoors. Third, both sports can make your hair fall out quicker than fast-forwarding an Army barber's training film. But before we agree that Sporting Clays deserves this moniker of golf with a gun, we should further weigh both the similarities and the differences in these sports. For starters, let's consider the similarities. Both sports refer to shooting around or taking a shot. The only problem is, in Sporting Clays, the term loaded has a slightly different meaning. Also, in both sports, you may walk the course or take a cart. Golf and Sporting Clays also may be recognized by their specialized clothing, a shooter's clothing, as compared to a golfer's clothing, spiked shoes as opposed to boots and safety glasses for a Sporting Clays guys. You'll also notice other miscellaneous differences. For instance, in a round of Sporting Clays, you will go through 50 to 100 shells. Golfers do only slightly better with golf balls. Likewise, in both sports, the player takes aim for what it's worth. Sporting Clays, you have some idea where the shot is headed. The one thing these sports have in common is their growing popularity. Sporting Clays has been more than 3 million participants each year, and like golf, many of them come back the next year. Perhaps this is where the similarities end and the differences begin. For starters, Sporting Clays stations are designed to duplicate actual hunting situations. Clay targets are thrown to duplicate landing ducks, crossing doves, rising quail. Golf, on the other hand, is its own unique form of torture. Furthermore, you typically carry a whole bag of clubs in golf, whereas in Sporting Clays, you can only have one gun. The big difference is that in Sporting Clays, more guns probably wouldn't help. Caddies would be a good addition to Sporting Clays, just like golf. Another difference is that in golf, the hole never moves, no matter what they say. Furthermore, in golf, you conceivably shoot until you hit the hole, as if that's a good thing. In sporting clays, once your shots are up, you're done. Sporting clays is merciful that way. Golf's a little more complicated. Sporting clays is a little easier. You break the target, you score it. In golf, strokes apparently count differently depending on whether you're playing with your boss or not. It goes on a little bit more, and I don't have time to give it full. But he writes for this blog, Rethink Rural. He says, also in sporting clays, you frequently get a true pair. In golf, you rarely do. And for those guys that shoot sporting clays, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the show. From Marty Walker, Palmetto Boat Center, I appreciate him being on there to tease our upcoming Southeastern High School bass class, is what we're calling it. It's going to be a great time with a bunch of kids. Appreciate Scott Laseth. Urge you to go on to his webpage, subscribe to his email newsletters. He's got some great, great recipes he posts up there all the time. And catch a show on TV. And if you're at SeaWee, you might get to see him or meet him in person. So as always, thank you for tuning in. Mia Fall is here. No better time to get out and enjoy what South Carolina has to offer. You know, last week we had Mary Rowe talk about the Palmetto Trail. Volunteer or go walk it, either way. I'm going to be taking some back roads this week. I'm going to make some time to get outdoors, enjoy some fresh air, even if it is with a football game. Hope you do the same. And as always, don't forget that camera. We'll see you here next Saturday on another hour of Woods and Water, South Carolina.
Ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? Yes, I'm